everybody. I am Ian Williams, President of the Foreign Press Association, and Trita Party, our frequent guest over the years, is the Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute, a distinguished body with some very distinguished contributors, including myself recently, on the question of quite who should be holding the former Soviet seat in the United Nations, and other things on these lines. So we are in a very complex situation where Trita could help us, we hope, with his expertise in these subtleties. Because in a world that seemed to have done away with nuance and reduced to binary systems of good and bad and red and dead, evil and otherwise, we suddenly found a situation where people were having to make value judgments. In particular, Washington had to decide whether it had hated Moscow or Tehran more, or whether it hated either more than Caracas. And then, of course, it has to decide about the Saudis. So there's a complex problem here, almost analogous to Turkey, which is trying to stay on side with Moscow, while on the other hand, being eager as a NATO member, and also because they're appalled at what's happening in Ukraine, to put some trammels on Moscow. So Trita, can you explain exactly where we are with the JCPOE, which Moscow was almost randomly holding hostage over its Ukrainian invasion?
Yes, so the Moscow intervention, which clearly set things back at least for a couple of days, appears to have been resolved now. The remaining obstacle is no longer what the Russians had put forward, which was very problematic. But now the remaining problems are between the United States and Iran itself on the issue of some sanctions relief issues, primarily when it comes to the designation of the IRGC as a terrorist organization, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, as well as an Iranian demand for assurances that the United States will not be exiting the deal again after 2025. The second one is an issue that already had been addressed. It had not necessarily been satisfactorily resolved, but it had been resolved in the sense that the parties moved on. But it seems to have been reopened now by the Iranians. And of course, the issue of the IRGC terrorist listing is a very sensitive one in Washington, but also a very important one for the Iranians. So at this point, everything else is resolved. The European issues are resolved. It's just between what's going to happen between the US and Iran on these last issues.
To what extent were Moscow's objections to the JCPOE substantive objections, or were they just an opportunistic wrench in the wheel because they could and because they wanted other things?
Well, there was a legitimate element to what they were demanding and one that was deemed illegitimate by the others. The legitimate one was that the Russians are written into the JCPOA. There's certain things within the JCPOA that they're going to be handling as they were doing it before, shipping out the Iranian LEU, et cetera. Some of that will require transactions of money, and the Russians wanted to make sure that their involvement in the JCPOA would be exempted from the sanctions that the United States had imposed on Russia as well as Europe. That is the part that was legitimate. That is the part that the US and the others agreed upon. We simply could not, on the one hand, say that Russia has to do X, Y, and Z, and then also say, oh, we're going to sanction you if you do X, Y, and Z. The part that was deemed illegitimate and rejected by the other sides was one in which the Russians essentially said, well, the JCPOA is normalizing Iran's trade with the rest of the world. That needs to include Russia as well. So there needs to be a full exemption for all of the trade between Russia and Iran from the sanctions of the US and the EU. And that's where the others disagreed and said that they're only going to be giving exemptions for Russia's involvement in the nuclear program and the JCPOA, not for its general trade with Iran. That trade, by the way, is very minimal. It's not particularly important. And that's why there was a strong impression that the Russians were doing this either to delay, and by that put more pressure on the US, because the delay would have meant that oil prices would remain high and create all kinds of other problems for the West, or to actually scuttle it altogether, which they also could do by delaying it long enough. And that they would do so as some form of a revenge, a way of making the US's and the EU's sanctions policy on Russia as costly as possible. After a couple of days, the Iranian foreign minister went to Iran and the issue got resolved. We don't have the details of exactly what happened in the sense of, did the Iranians offer something to the Russians? Did they agree to something else? It's not known at this point, but the issue has been resolved in the sense that the Russians are only getting the exemptions for their involvement in the JCPOA, but nothing more. And they have so far seemed to be satisfied with it. Let's hope that that is not something that's going to change in the next couple of days, because if it does, then once again, we may go through the same exercise, but next time it may not end up in a positive outcome.
Did this take much pressure from Tehran? And was this what form was the pressure taking?
Well, this was highly problematic for the Iranians for a couple of reasons. First of all, it revealed how vulnerable the Iranian government is to mood swings in Moscow. This is quite embarrassing for the Iranians. The Iranians are insisting that they're pursuing an independent policy. They're neither aligned with the West or the East. That is clearly not the case, because the Iranians are quite vulnerable to mood swings in Russia. Moreover, the Iranians want this deal, and they want it relatively fast. Oil prices are very high. It's going to be a big move for their economy to be able to sell oil again in large quantities. So it was important for them to be able to get that. But thirdly, also, if the Russians were actually scuttling the deal, then that would then have completely undermined what the Iranians have been seeking for the last year, which is an American return to the JCPOA. So, but then the Iranians were put in a very difficult situation, because they're vulnerable to the Russians and they don't have a lot of counter leverage over the Russians. And the option of the Iranians essentially striking a deal directly with the US instead of through the P5+1 essentially would have meant that they would have gone around Russia's back, and they would have probably begotten a generation of enmity, 2 decades of enmity with Russia. And they would have been doing so for what? For a JCPOA with sanctions relief that the Iranians as well as the American side do not believe is going to last more than 2.5 years, because of a Republican promises that they're going to quit the deal again if they take the White House in 2.5 years. So they couldn't ditch the Russians, because there's no welcoming committee for them to join the US. And at the same time, they couldn't go to the US side, because it would only be a short-term deal, and they would have burnt the bridge and ended up with a long-term enmity with the Russians at the same time.
This has got even more implications, of course, because it's got so many factors. It's almost open for the butterfly factor of chaos coming in. How does this play into the relationship with the Saudis and the Emirati, who seem to have, damped down the fires against Tehran over the last year? In comparison with earlier, but you know, in this particular epicycle of the balance of power, how does that work out?
So the Emiratis and the Saudis have a different position compared to what they did in 2015. 2015, they were clearly against the deal. They did not want to see any type of an agreement between the United States and Iran, regardless of the details of it. They didn't want to have any improvement of relations. They felt abandoned. They felt that the United States had essentially shifted strategically and wanted to tilt towards Iran and abandon its relations or its strategic partnerships with Saudi and the UAE. That is not the position that they're taking today. Today, they have come to realize, thanks to what happened during the Trump years, that the United States is not going to come to their defense in a war with Iran. And that if there is a US-Iran war, the Saudis and the Emiratis will pay a tremendously high price, and there's not that much the US can do about it. As you recall, there were these attacks on the Saudi oil fields, attacks against ships in the Persian Gulf, many of them from the UAE. And the signals were quite clear that if there was a war, the Iranians would target Saudi Arabia and the UAE as a punishment for them having pushed the United States to go to war with Iran. This has caused a significant rethink on the side of Abu Dhabi and Riyadh. Now they're favoring an agreement. Certainly the Abu Dhabi, the Emiratis are. They may not love it. They may not be excited about it, but they recognize that they're better off with it than without. And it is also compelling to recognize that they need to have their own diplomacy with Iranians so that they can insulate their relationship from U.S.-Iran tension. So even if there is a higher likelihood of a confrontation between the U.S. and Iran down the road, it will not play out against Saudi or UAE. They will not be drawn into that conflict. But at least with the Saudis, it's quite clear. Unless there is a JCPOA, they're not going to go full forward with their diplomacy with Iran. If there is a JCPOA, I think you will actually see it having a significant trickle-down impact on relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran and the UAE. Again, it's not going to be a love fest. They're not going to become partners or best friends, but there's going to be a significant reduction of their tensions and hopefully a spillover into what's happening in Iraq and what is happening in Yemen.
Well, that was where I was going to come to, because this ever-complex sort of Rube Goldberg structure includes Yemen. I mean, so far, I think the only thing that's protected the Saudis and the Emirates and their Western allies over Yemen is the fact that most people don't know about it. So the orthodox version that the Houthis are sort of particularly barbaric Islamic surrogates of Tehran holds sway because nobody's really thought about it very much. I don't believe that myself. And I also believe that what the Saudis and the Emirates are doing there is constitutes war crimes, from what I've seen. But somehow they've been shielded. They've almost become pseudo-Israel in the sense that no one wants to pass a resolution against them at the United Nations.
In fact, there was a resolution in the United Nations that was passed in the Security Council just days after the Ukrainian one, in which the Emiratis got through language that they had fought for, which was that the Houthis should be declared a terrorist organization. The Russians voted in favor of that, which is likely because the Emiratis abstained on the resolution targeting Russia over Ukraine. So we're seeing the type of give and take that is taking place there. But you're quite correct. The war in Yemen is not receiving anywhere near the type of attention as it should, compared to certainly the amount of attention that Ukraine has garnered in a very short period of time. They will not be able to commit these crimes in Yemen, the Saudis and the Emiratis, had it not been for the very active support of the United States. And here, I think there's a very sad development, because when President Biden came in, he pledged to put an end to this war. He made a speech in early February 2021, and he said this war must end. During the campaign, he had said that we're going to show the Saudis, the world, that the Saudis are a pariah. None of this is happening. Yes, he's not embracing MBS publicly, but at the end of the day, there's been a significant increase in the support for Saudi Arabia and the UAE in the war in Yemen. The language of the administration in terms of how it condemns the Houthis and the language they use in those condemnations is almost as if the Houthis had attacked Wisconsin. There's been plenty of condemnations of the Houthis, not a single condemnation of any of the attacks the Saudis and the Emiratis have committed against Yemen. And incidentally, the attacks by the Saudis and the Emiratis on Yemen are far, far larger than the attacks by the Houthis on Saudi Arabia, with a factor of 6 or 7, I believe. And the escalation has primarily been from the Saudi and the Emirati side. There's a narrative out there that this Yemeni, that the Houthis have escalated. The Houthis have escalated within Yemen, within that civil war. They have not escalated in their attacks against Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have dramatically escalated their attacks on Yemen in the last couple of months with the complete blessing and support of the Biden administration. And the reason for this shift appears to be that the Biden administration had concluded that in their competition with China, most of that competition is not going to take place in the South China Sea. It's going to take place in Africa, in South America, in the Middle East. And as a result, a key element of America's arsenal against the Chinese in that competition is its alliances. And it's essential to keep allies or strategic partners on your side and make sure that they don't jump ship and join the Chinese. And for that, it means that the United States would actually become more deferential to the reckless policies of the Emiratis and the Saudis. And that is exactly what we're seeing right now. And one would think that perhaps after they did not vote in a favorable way on Russia from a US perspective, that this would have caused a degree of rethink in the White House. It appears to have done the opposite. It appears to have led them to think that they had not been kind and hugging enough of the Saudis compared to what they should be in order to get them to align with the United States.
To what extent do you think the Emirati and Saudi responses were coordinated with Israel? Because all of them have, from the outside, from an outside perspective, been incredibly provocative in playing footsie with Moscow over the last few months. I rather think if Biden had Trump's temperament, there would have been a phone call saying, "Hey, what you doing? Watch it. We're coming to get you." But it doesn't seem to be in Biden's nature to use the big stick, Lyndon Johnson style.
It certainly has not, and it appears to be that the argument that is winning within the White House is that that won't work, but that hugging the Saudis further will. I've seen no evidence that that would be the case.
It didn't work for Khashoggi, though, did it?
It certainly has not. But I do think it's also because the Biden administration believe themselves to be very, very vulnerable. Because if they don't get the Saudis to pump up more oil and reduce oil prices, then you're going to see continued rising gas prices and a significant inflationary impact that will have on the US economy right before the US midterm elections. And that is definitely on the minds of the folks in the White House. So it appears that out of fear of that, instead of getting tough, they're getting softer. And paradoxically, or perhaps not so paradoxically, that won't work. It's just going to make matters worse. In fact, all of that pressure so far has only caused MBS to become more bold. And we see that now when they're even releasing stories and saying that Saudi Arabia is in conversations with the Chinese to sell oil, not denominated in dollars, but in the Chinese currency. That would be a very, very hostile step from the US perspective.
And what can the US do about it? I mean, the old adage of from Teddy Roosevelt was speak softly and carry a big stick. And Joe Biden seems to be speaking softly and carrying a floppy stick at the moment.
Yeah, I think getting really tough with the Saudis actually would be working. I mean, we saw that on a few occasions that Trump, you know, made statements that these countries will not be able to last 2 weeks without American protection, and the Saudis shifted position. There's nothing that says that Biden could not do the same thing. But I think in the longer run, there needs to be more than just that. A, there needs to be a diversification so that the United States is not just relying on Saudi Arabia, the Emirates. If Iranian oil is coming back on the market and if sanctions are lifted in a way so that investments can be made in the Iranian energy sector, which is needed in order for their capacity to pump up more oil grows, then I think you would find the United States having other options. Doesn't mean that the United States and Iran should become strategic partners. I don't think that's in the cards, but it would increase American maneuverability so that the US would have other options than just relying on the Saudis. Moreover, even more importantly, perhaps, is to really do a deep, deep investment in green technology in order to reduce the vulnerability and the dependence on oil producing countries, whether that is Saudi Arabia or whether that is Russia.
Do you see any serious signs of that at the moment?
I do not. I think we have a rhetoric that says that climate change is the existential threat. We're not seeing how policies are adjusted to that reality. I'm not seeing it to the extent that I think is needed. Certainly the Biden administration has invested in green technology, but it's not at the level where it should be. And it should be not just because of climate change, but also because of cutting us off this dependence on some of these countries that over and over again have proven themselves to be pursuing their own interests, which you cannot blame them for, but their interest is not coinciding with ours.
Mm-hmm. Well, to some extent, with Putin's miscalculation, everything has changed, and the incremental changes, when you see countries like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan making tentative gestures towards Ukraine, for example, it makes you think that really Putin must have overplayed his card, because these were secure satrapies in the past. You know, yes, they vied for independence. It reminds me of Prince Sihanouk in Cambodia in the good old days, and we know where that led to, Red Kampuchea. But both Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan have made gestures recently. Do you see any signs in the region that Russian influence has prestige has been diminishing? Because
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that. I mean, I think it's a fairly accepted consensus now, without the triumphalism of the tabloids, that the Russians have really made a urine poor showing militarily so far.
Certainly. And I think that is causing a lot of question marks and rethinking on a whole lot of different levels and a whole lot of different places. The show is, of course, not over. So where this ends up is not certain yet. But even if it ends up where the Russians are probably moving it towards, which is to make sure that Ukraine ends up being an independent state, not a member of NATO, can have economic ties, et cetera, with Europe, but it's not going to be hosting foreign bases, et cetera. Even if those Russian objectives are achieved, I think there will still be a lot of different countries that will have massive question marks about Russia's capabilities, given how badly they perform and how badly they miscalculated. But I think that needs to nevertheless be separated from the fact of, okay, but does that mean that those specific countries have legitimate other options that they perceive to be genuine? In the case of Iran, it doesn't. It does not perceive there to be another alternative for it, because it's not as if the West is welcoming Iran to shift camps. So it just makes their situation much worse. I can't speak for how the Ukrainians or the Uzbeks or Kazakhstan or others are seeing their situation. I'm sure it's quite different from that of the Iranian. But in the case of Iran, as we were talking about it, you know, even if they wanted to jump, where would they jump? They don't see another option for them. The JCPOA in itself is an example of that, because an agreement was signed, but then the United States walked away from it. And it's taken almost a year to get back into it. And we still don't know if that is going to succeed or not.
Well, moving on to the JCPOA and the American adherence to it, we've seen whether it works or not, the certain factions in the Israeli government, shall we say, and in their surrogates in Washington, are against any move to normalize relations with Iran, regardless of the reality of the threat. Their own intelligence agencies tell them that Iran is not an imminent nuclear weapons threat. But you'd never guess that listening to the talk in Washington. So to what extent is this this rivalry going to be overcome, to the extent of maintaining the JCPOA if it's agreed? If it's a document with a sort of a half-life of a minor isotope in a nuclear reactor, or whether it's something substantial and substantial and lead-like?
Well, I think in the case of Europe, the situation is different. The opportunity, the possibility, the lack of political resistance to improving relations, most of them already have normalized relations. Even Britain has its ambassador back in Iran after, you know, the Iranians attacked the embassy and sacked it a couple of years ago. So on that end, I think it can work, but I think it will happen with far less enthusiasm than was the case after 2015. Then there was a genuine belief that there could be a transformative element to the JCPOA. That is largely missing right now, partly because of what has happened. The Iranians don't trust the West. They feel vindicated. They feel that the Europeans have no influence. They will end up doing whatever the US tells it to do anyways. So investing in Europe doesn't have much of a return. And on the other hand, you now have an Iranian government that is very hardline, that is oriented towards not shifting towards the West, but looking east anyways. And all of these different things just makes the opportunity far, far smaller. And it would require far greater political capital and will to capitalize on it than it did in 2015. On the US-Iran side, it's essentially zero, I would say. Unless there is at least a year or so of very flawless implementation of the JCPOA, I don't think the Iranians are likely to entertain any broader warm-up with the US. And on the American side as well, it's not as if the Biden administration is eager to, after the JCPOA, move in that direction with the aim of having an improved relationship in the midst of its efforts to divide the world between democracies and non-democracies. There's already plenty of contradictions in that frame adding more to it is probably not going to be something that the administration is going to be eager to do. And again, neither side believe this deal is going to last more than 2.5 years. So given that, I just don't see much potential or political will to move in that direction.
Well, this, I mean, the idea that we're dividing the world into democracies and non-democracies when the alleged democracies include Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and Brazil under Bolsonaro and so on. And in fact, Britain under Boris Johnson at the moment. all of these, you know, this looks like a spurious attempt to tack an ideological framework on a strictly real politics struggle.
And also in an unhelpful way, because it's really hard to see how that in any way, shape or form actually is going to be helpful unless we want to see some form of a new Cold War and we want to define it in such a way so that the cleavages are and the frontiers are a little bit more clear. But for the idea of it actually helping us usher in a new era of peace and understanding in the world, then I don't find that to be particularly helpful. And keep in mind, you know, oftentimes we hear in the debate an implicit belief that international law applies to non-democracies, but not to democracies. Democracies essentially get a pass. That is a very fast way of undermining international law.
Which we saw as a concomitant of the General Assembly vote condemning Russia, where a lot of people were saying, yes, why?
Yeah, exactly. So it's already before what the Russians did, we had already had 2 decades of the United States increasingly setting aside international law and undermining the institutions for it. And even with the Biden administration clearly saying that they want to fight for the rules-based order, et cetera, they had also communicated to UN officials that when they say rules-based order, they don't mean a UN-centric rules-based order. Well, if it's not centered on the UN and international law, then what is it based on? Is it then centered on American power? Because if it's centered on American power, then how is it different from the world vision of Donald Trump?
Well, we have the standing quandary that we have White House officials calling Putin a war criminal, and the White House has still not walked back the Bush-era circumspection put on the International Criminal Court.
Yeah, so, you know, we want to take Putin to the International Criminal Court, but we are at the same time not joining it, and we are sanctioning and threatening the judges of the International Criminal Court. I mean, it just doesn't work out this way. So I think I'm hoping that instead of thinking that what the Russians did there and the Russian invasion of Ukraine is an illegal war, it's a violation of international law, that would lead people to think that, okay, we need to have a more aggressive United States that kind of deters Russia or other countries from doing so. Well, a more aggressive United States is exactly what we've had in the last 25 years. And the end result of that has been a long series of disastrous interventions, wars in many places, that a global war on terror that has killed more people than terrorism itself has killed, cost more than $6.4 trillion and counting. And on top of that, it has further undermined international law and international institutions.
Well, that was one of the continual debridements of the whole concept of sanctions and international laws, because of its abuse over Iraq and Iran, come to think of it. Issue after issue where the US has enforced extraterritoriality has sort of produced compliance fatigue in many countries.
It certainly has. And I think the more, you know, even strong advocates of these extraterritorial sanctions or financial sanctions have warned that an overuse of it is going to incentivize other countries to create their own payment systems. The Russians already did so after 2014. The Chinese are doing so. They're talking to each other about connecting those payment systems. And you may very well end up having an alternative payment system that takes away a tremendous amount of coercive power that the United States has had. And that's the thing with power. You have to wield it responsibly in order not to lose it. And I think the last 2 decades of the manner in which the US has used and wielded that power has not been in the responsible category and as a result has incentivized countries to create their own system. We may not be there yet, but we will get there pretty soon and probably faster than most people think. And that will cost the United States a lot of that power that it had.
Well, I've been predicting this for 20 years, and I must say, it's always just across the horizon. It's a bit like the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. As you get towards it, it always seems to disappear.
Well, I think this time, well, if you mean that there would be a disappearance of that financial system or an alternative system.
An erosion of the domination of the US.
Yeah, the erosion. Yeah, well, I think it is happening. Again, it's not going to happen overnight, but, you know, many of the countries in the Middle East, for instance, that did vote with the US are technically squarely publicly in the US sector. They're all kind of terrified that if the US is willing to go so fast from 0 to 100 when it comes to sanctions, this is a massive vulnerability that many of these countries have. And even if they have nothing to worry about in the sense that they're not about to invade another country, et cetera, or do anything of what the Russians have done, it nevertheless behooves people that are working in the security establishments of all of these different countries to consider these different eventualities. That eventuality 2 years ago looked very, very more marginal than it does today. So the more countries are starting to think about this in a more serious way, that in and of itself is going to move forward that timeline.
Well, Simon Locke has been asking in the background there about the actual efficacy of the JCPOA. We've discussed this in the past. Is Iran going to forswear the nuclear option in a truly, deeply and sincere way as a result of the deal? Or has it already? Or is it a Kimmerer?
It already has.
Yes.
It already has. I mean, the JCPOA is exactly that. If the Iranians really wanted nuclear weapons, they had the best excuse that anyone could have asked for. They signed the JCPOA, the United States exited the deal, was condemned by most of the world for having done so, and the Iranians could have gone down the path of a nuclear weapon if they felt that that is actually what they really wanted. That is not what's been their key objective. Their key objective has been to have their own fuel cycle enrichment on their own soil, but be able to be reintegrated with the world economically and politically. And that is the pathway that the JCPOA provided while it blocked off the pathway to a bomb. That's the one that they've now chosen twice. So as long as we live up to our end of the bargain, it seems to me that the track record indicates that there's a decent chance that the Iranians will live up to their end of the bargain as well. They did so last time around. Can it prevent Iran from going in the direction of a nuclear bomb 50 years from now? Well, there's too many variables into that equation. Neither signing or not signing can necessarily give you an answer to that. But what we can tell you about the next 10 to 15 years is that if they've signed it, they have made it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for them to be able to shift towards a nuclear weapon for the foreseeable future, which goes beyond the 15 years, because even after the 15 years, they will still be allowing inspections at a much higher level than they did before the JCPOA. They've signed, implemented, and will by then have ratified it, the additional protocol. Those are the best instruments we have against the nuclear Iran, far superior to anything else that have been tried, whether it's maximum pressure sanctions, threats of regime change. All of those different things do not have anything to show for in terms of any efficacy whatsoever. The only thing that actually has paused, rolled back the program has been the JCPOA. I'm kind of stunned that there still is a debate about that.
Well, because it's not really a debate. It's a political catch-calling, isn't it? It's political gotcha. If you start from the default that Iran is an enemy of Israel and is therefore evil, and let's look for an excuse to do it. It's either terrorism or nuclear weapons. Hmm. I'm sure before long, chemical and biological weapons factories will be discerned.
Certainly. Just look at the debate in the last couple of months. As soon as it started to become clear that perhaps there will be a JCPOA, opponents of the JCPOA started pushing a completely different narrative, which was the nuclear program was never the real problem. The missile program is the real problem. So whenever one issue is resolved, they make up another issue in order to keep the confrontation and the enmity alive.
So the issue is Iran and its non-compliance with Western and Israeli mandate.
Ultimately, I think it is that as long as you have an Iran that is not pliant, it is not adjusting to Western demands or accepting American hegemony in the Middle East, there's going to be tensions and problems. This was even seen to a certain extent during the time of the Shah, where he had a very different regime. It wasn't anywhere near the kind of hostility, et cetera, but there was a lot of annoyance in Washington, thinking that the Iranians were, or that the Shah was...
Too big for his boots.
Yeah, too big for his boots, exactly. And then the Israel angle, of course, is very, very important from the Israeli perspective. The idea that Iran would be normalized as a country, its nuclear program, had normal relations with the United States, while it continues to reject Israel's existence, or at least does not recognize Israel's existence, and pushes a very pro-Palestinian line, they're not going to be willing to accept it. Whether the pretext is the nuclear program, missiles, or anything else, keeping that conflict alive has been part of the Israeli playbook. I thought it was very interesting, was an interview with a senior Israeli official, I forgot his name right now, in April of last year. And the reporter asked him, but you know, now we have clear evidence that Trump's sanctions did not work. Iran's nuclear program is way more advanced now than it was before. It's dangerous. I mean, from an Israeli perspective, you must have regrets, essentially, that it has turned out this way. And his answer was that, keep in mind, had Trump not exited the nuclear deal, Iran would today not be on the agenda. But because he exited the deal, Iran is on the agenda. He's talking about the Western agenda of countries that we have problems with. So by exiting the deal, we ensured that there would still be a conflict around Iran. And he was essentially putting that forward as an argument as to why it was good that Trump pulled out of the agreement. I think it says a lot.
It's a very Machiavellian argument, or Levantine, you could almost say, bearing in mind the geographical context. So I know you have to go soon. So we have... things have taken a spin. There's obviously been a loop in the road. What is the situation, if you take the Iranian domestic situation, is there likely to be any let up in the hardness of the government under domestic pressure, or is there any domestic pressure? And what effect would that have on the overall balance of factors in the region?
I think, unfortunately, the domestic situation in Iran has gone in a very bad direction to a certain extent because of the US pullout of the JCPOA. People's expectations were extremely high that things were going to move in the right direction because of the JCPOA. And economically, in the beginning, it did move in the right direction. But then with the JCPOA, Iran ended up under more sanctions than it had ever been before, even comparing it to the period in which there was no JCPOA. The devastation that did to the Iranian economy did not just turn people against the country's leaders, a tremendous amount of anger with the corruption, mismanagement, and everything else, but it also fundamentally undermined confidence in the Iranian public writ large when it comes to the idea that negotiations with the West is the ticket out for Iran from its economic and political isolation and problems. That this needs to be resolved by having some sort of an accommodation with the West. That was the line of Rouhani and Zarif and that faction. And whereas it seemed to have worked out quite well in the beginning, with the US pulling out of the agreement, imposing even worse sanctions on Iran, the hardliners in Iran pushed the narrative very hard, saying, well, of course the US would do that. We know that they would do that. It's not their primary fault because the US is the US. It is Rouhani's fault for not having prepared a plan B and a plan C for this eventuality. And that was an argument that was sufficiently effective to cause a lot of people who had voted for Rouhani years earlier, roughly 20 million of them, to stay home from the elections last year. And as a result, give the hardliners a victory, even though the participation rate in the election was the lowest it had been since the revolution. So unfortunately, on the domestic front, it does not appear to have to look particularly optimistic, at least in the short and the medium term. You look out 8, 12 years ahead, I think something's gonna have to change, because ultimately the kind of sentiments that exist right now, in which people essentially more or less have just resigned themselves to the rise of the hardliners, is going to change, but it's going to take some time. But it's going to be a period in which they're going to be in much stronger control of the country than they have been for a very, very long time.
Okay, I think that's pretty much all. I know you have to leave soon, so we'll wind up. This is Ian Williams, President of the Foreign Press Association, and we've been doing a run around the houses and the souks and the barracks with Trita Parsi in the relations of the Gulf with the Saudis, with the Ukrainians, with the Russians, and with everybody else. It's a very complex situation, and it isn't susceptible to reduction to binaries and the binary dialectics that people try to apply to these things on both sides, which is why we welcome Trita Parsi's broad-ranging expertise and ability to juggle all of these balls in the air, intellectually at least, while we're talking to them. Next week, we have on Wednesday at 11, we have a panel on the sound of silence. Where is the UN in Ukraine? Where is the UN Secretary General? Why is the UN Secretary General not there? These are questions that several close observers of the UN, inside, outsiders, will be answering, and we'll probably get barred from the UN for life by the time they've finished. So this next Wednesday at 11 o'clock, look forward to seeing you. Please sign up and we'll get more, and welcome Trita back soon. When, who knows, yet another turn of the clock will bring something new for the JCPOA, on or off, as the case may be. Thank you very much, Trita.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.